The Supreme Court says now you got to pay sales tax on everything. We'll talk about it on The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are The Uprising with Scott Cosenza and Tim Donner.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
Hey, a president. Can you believe it?
I love the poorly educated.
The voters have guaranteed themselves slavery, economic disaster.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
I have never met with Russians.
Our elected representatives can abuse subordinates and then secretly use a slush fund of our money to pay them off.
Black Lives Matter, the Antifa movement, is interested in preserving the fabric of America.
This is The Uprising, the podcast of LibertyNation.com. Tim Donner and Scott Cosenza double teaming this week. Okay, Supreme Court was busy this week, extended their decision-making by a day, which is a rare occurrence, but they came up with one decision that will affect consumers from coast to coast from here on in. So let's talk about that.
Eager, Tim, to get to their fancy European vacations sponsored by the well-moneyed law students of this country that do semesters abroad in Tuscany and the like. They extended their session to get out the volume of cases that have are still waiting to come down the pike. This was a big one, Tim. It's the case of South Dakota v. Wayfair. A number of online retailers sued South Dakota because South Dakota tried to collect sales taxes from or demand that, excuse me, so they weren't trying to collect the sales taxes from the companies. They were demanding that the companies collect the sales taxes from their customers who resided in South Dakota. And anybody who sort of pays attention to these things online knows that if the company that you're doing business with has no presence in your state, no offices or warehouses or distribution facilities, that you don't have to pay sales taxes to that on that transaction. Well, that went away yesterday, Tim. That is no longer the law of the land in the United States of America. We don't actually know what the law is in the sense of what will be allowed and what won't be allowed going forward because the Supreme Court only ruled on this one particular case. So we do know that South Dakota, in accordance with the law that they passed in order to be able to tax out-of-state sellers, will be able to proceed with their taxing rubric. We're not sure yet about where the line will be drawn with other states and other taxings.
Oh, it sounds similar to a decision that we discussed last week on religious liberty and the whole gay wedding cake thing, where the decision was narrow and based strictly on that case, but didn't necessarily form a precedent for all states and all situations going forward. Yes.
Yes, there were. So, for instance, in South Dakota, there were two exceptions to the law that people can sell things in South Dakota without having to comply with the taxing authorities if they meet one of these exceptions. If you want to do business in South Dakota and you sell less than 200 items, you engage in less than 200 sales transactions per year there, and your total business book is less than $100,000, then you don't have to comply with their license, you know, their submission requirements to collect sales tax from their residents and then submit it. We don't know if maybe a company could make it 10 transactions. And does it count if I'm an eBay seller and I have, you know, where is this going to go? I suspect, Tim, that we're going to see a race to the bottom in terms of the requirements. Legislators and legislatures are not known for leaving meat on the bone when it comes to taxable receipts. You know, it's one of these things where you read the Amici briefs for the case, and they talk about stuff like lost revenue. And it's hilarious when the court discusses it because it's like, excuse me, lost revenue means money from me and you and our pocketbooks that we're now going to have to pay to these taxing authorities. For people who may not really fully understand the breadth of this, the impact of this decision, Tim, there are estimated by the court over 12,000 taxing authorities in the United States. So every state's a taxing authority, mostly every county's a taxing authority, many cities and other jurisdictions are taxing authorities. For instance, we have the Roots of Liberty curriculum that we offer for sale, mm-hmm. as well as the Roots of Liberty text, the edited volume. We sell those. When I say we're now, I don't mean that like we're in criminal liability today, but going forward from the date of this decision, we're now going to have to be likely liable in many places we sell to collect sales taxes from those places and then remit them. And as you might imagine, Tim, the penalties for doing that incorrectly or not doing it at all, it's not like, don't worry about it. Just send us the money then. You know, it's a big problem, right? With criminal penalties and interests. And I mean, it's dealing with the government is obviously a frustrating thing. Often case now now every seller of online goods is going to have to deal with 12,000 of them to the extent that they want to do business with an open model. There are softwares that help people negotiate this, but they're not foolproof at all. And they're also not a guarantee against a charge of failure to submit. So you can't say, well, I relied on this software company to be in compliance. The law doesn't work that way.
So this was a narrow ruling, but there seems to be the clear sense that this is going to affect consumers in every state going forward, because if this Supreme Court precedent has been laid down, doesn't it effectively mean that we can pretty much figure that we're going to have to pay sales tax on every online transaction in every state going forward? Or is that too big a jump from where we are now based on this single Supreme Court decision?
A year from today, Tim, when every legislature of all the 50 states will have had a chance to sit from the time this decision was announced, I believe that absolutely yes. 1 year from today, you won't be able to buy a thing that doesn't have a sales tax associated with it.
What about the role of retailers in so-called brick and mortar stores, the kind that we grew up buying everything from, and which are now really suffering under the weight of Amazon and other online purveyors of merchandise who make it so easy.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't they been pushing for a long time for a more aggressive scheme of internet taxation that would not leave them at the current disadvantage that they have? In terms of selling stuff, everything they sell has to be taxed?
Yes. And I think that the prime motivators politically aren't actually those Main Street merchants, Tim, but more the governments themselves. There were over 50 signatories, 50 state over 40 state governments basically submitted word to the court that this is really important to us and we want you to, you know, it's vital for our situation that we be able to make these taxes. Now, South Dakota is perhaps not as bad as the old Dominion where we live with their tax. They don't actually have an income
tax. That would be Virginia.
Yes, sir. They only have a sales tax. That's how they primarily fund their government, is with a sales tax. So they're saying, look, the people of our state have decided that that's how we're funding our government. And you're not letting us really, this is the way people purchase goods now. They don't purchase them at the Main Street store. They purchase them online, and you're basically forbidding us from doing so in a way that the Constitution doesn't allow you to forbid us. So just so people are clear, perhaps we can go back to the past a little bit and say, this was the Supreme Court overruling themselves. In, I believe it was 1992, they came out with a decision called Quill, and that decision basically set up the rule that unless you were physically located in the state, that the state couldn't tax you.
Mm-hmm.
That seemed to me to be a fairly sound provision on the basis that the taxing comes with, you know, control over an area is sort of typically in law and history what gave you the ability to tax that area. So it would make sense that you would only be taxing entities and people that are, you know, sort of within the confines of your, you know, where you can lay hands on them. It's funny too, I think I used the term strange bedfellows in my written piece on LibertyNation.com about this case. Kennedy wrote the opinion for the majority. He was joined by Thomas, Alito, Ginsburg, and Gorsuch.
Wow, Ginsburg and Gorsuch on the same side.
Yeah, it's not something that you see very often.
Right.
Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan signed on to Roberts' dissent. It doesn't make any sense. It's sort of like, So then there was another decision announced with cell phone privacy, subsequent to the sales tax decision, Tim. And it's another one of these strange bedfellows decision. In that case, we had Roberts delivering the opinion of the court, the majority opinion, joined by Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. And in the dissent is Kennedy, joined by Thomas and Alito, and Gorsuch. So there's been almost all seems all these cases are 5-4, these big cases, and now we're getting some really kind of fractured lines along the sort of typical alliances. And what I'm finding for my analysis, Tim, for the sort of pro-liberty analysis, which I hope try to bring to the table always, we're getting with the majority opinions, we're getting good results but bad law. And what I mean by that is, I think it's very good that the Constitution itself doesn't prohibit this in explicit terms. And if those of us who want the Constitution's provisions to be interpreted based on the plain letter of the of those provisions and not read too deeply into it, it's fair to come up with this result. However, we hate the fact that states are going to be able to collect sales, so we want people to be free from taxes.
But it's not up to the Supreme Court to save us from additional fees. I mean, and I'm sure everybody would agree with that. We would have liked the decision to be different so that we'd never have to...
This is the bane of the strict constructionist, the person who puts the principle ahead of the result, which is that sometimes it's a lot more vinegar than it is honey, and the medicine doesn't get that teaspoon of sugar. So that's, I think, what we have here. With the, meaning, and just so in case anybody's a little bit confused about that analysis, what I mean by that is, while I would prefer to not have internet, for the internet taxes case, the court is probably correct in that the Constitution doesn't prohibit it, but I don't like that result. I wish that either the Constitution did prohibit it or federal law. The court said in 1992 in the Quill decision to him, and again this week, hey, Congress, seems like you're the party to create an elegant solution here. We make very simple rulings. Craft a solution. Come in here and legislate in this area.
But we can't do we can never get to a point where we promote the idea of results-based Supreme Court decisions.
Yes. Tempting though it
because
may be.
That's really what we see the left do, and some of the right of center justices
read Roe v. Wade for a textbook example of how that comes out.
Now, one of the questions that's interesting here is what principle they base this decision on, and it seems like there isn't some principle because you've got different ideological stripes joining in dissent and in writing of the decision. I mean, in the case of, for example, the gay wedding case, you're talking about a constitutional issue of religious liberty. In the cell phone case, you're talking about a Fourth Amendment issue, which is the right not to be subjected to unreasonable search and seizure. But what principle is in play? What principle was applied in forming this particular Supreme Court decision about sales tax over the internet across state lines?
So I think that because the ruling this week explicitly overrules a prior Supreme Court case, Quill, that it's not about this case representing a principle rather than them discovering or deciding that the principle that decided the earlier case was incorrect. And that's what they wrote about. And they said that, you know, in Quill, they said that the Constitution's Commerce Clause, that the due process rights afforded under the Commerce Clause prevented a seller of goods to have to comply with any and all taxing jurisdictions that exist elsewhere. They've now said that, oopsie, it doesn't really mean that, which is interesting because they actually use language that that discusses the current state of commerce in the country, which I think is interesting because if the Constitution requires us to submit to taxing authorities across state lines, well, it seems to me that it requires that whether there's the day one of internet sales and there's only $1 worth of internet sales or whatever day we're on now with billions likely being bought and sold over the internet in a day, right? So why does that matter? That's one of those things where I think it shouldn't matter. I think it's actually... it should be impermissible to consider that. The Supreme Court is not supposed to come to practical conclusions.
Right.
They're supposed to say what the law is and what the Constitution is. And if we don't like the law, there are mechanisms to change it. And if we don't like the Constitution, there are mechanisms to change that. But
and
there are no mechanisms to change a Supreme Court decision that we don't like except for Well, go ahead.
A later Supreme Court to change the... So what this shows, too, is the sort of human fallibility of the court writ large going back historically. In the Catholic faith, they have an expression called ex cathedra, which means that when the Pope says something, it is authoritative by virtue of the fact that the Pope said it.
Mm-hmm.
That happens with the court as well, essentially, because their ruling stands, can't be overruled until they themselves overrule a previous court. So on the one hand, you sort of have a court that says, well, wait a minute, 25 years ago, you ruled differently. But on the other hand, you have a court where you could say, well, good for you for... you know, staying current with the times and the changing mm-hmm. circumstances. Which of those arguments takes precedence, I think, would you say, in this case?
Well, John Roberts is not Christ's vicar on earth. I can say that. But he is the Chief Justice of these United States, and he does have massive amount of power there. But, you know, in the Supreme Court terms, he's one of nine. And in terms of these votes, he's one of nine. The Supreme Court could overrule themselves again on this point. The minority view in this case, so I think I gave the list before and I'll give it one more time. Kennedy wrote the decision for the minority, and he was joined by Thomas, Alito, Ginsburg, and Gorsuch. They essentially disagreed with the majority decision because of upturning the apple cart. They mm-hmm. thought that it would be such a problem for them to reverse their own previously made up law. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I mean, they created this law.
Right. Somebody had to create it.
They interpreted the Constitution and created a law. And now they're smashing it to bits. And the dissenters say, we can't do that. The notion that we should be able to willy-nilly do this, it creates a problem in law. There's a notion called, or there's a legal maxim called stare decisis, which I think the decision stands, I believe is the Latin for it. And for lower courts, it means that if the Supreme Court has addressed it or a higher court has addressed it, then the decision stands. And it also means for the same court, whether it's the Supreme Court itself or lower courts. So if you were a appellate court judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals and the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals had addressed an issue a decade earlier, while there's no legal requirement that you follow the same judgment that was laid down by another justice on your same court level because it's not above you, the principle of stare decisis means basically you better have a damn good reason if you're gonna change the course now of a course laid down. And if you think about, Tim, all the energy and lives that are devoted into a certain channel when you have these decisions that are made. Hey, let's not put the warehouse in California. Mm-hmm. Let's put it mm-hmm. in Nevada. Sure. You know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that happens. The decisions that are made, lives are changed based on these decisions. It does make a lot of sense for them not to change course unless there is a really good reason. And the majority says that reason is present here. They actually said, look, we made this mess. It's actually incumbent upon us to clean it up. And that's what we're doing here today by saying, go ahead and tax it and let the Congress fix it if they want.
Last question. Given the narrow nature of this decision and the fact that it isn't a sweeping decision that immediately changes laws in all 50 states, is the Supreme Court not now almost obligated to accept more and more of these kind of cases so they can build up some reservoir of Supreme Court decisions around which states can figure out what they need to do?
Tim, they're going to have to. Firstly, I don't know that I agree with you that because we use terms like narrow to define mm-hmm. that it's not sweeping. I think mm-hmm. it can actually mm-hmm. be narrowly drawn but sweeping. I don't think that that's a contradiction. Perhaps it is, but I don't think so. So I just wanted to put a pin in that.
Sure.
But the answer to your question is absolutely. So here's what's going to happen. The Supreme Court cannot abide what is called a split in the circuits. What that means is our federal judicial system is drawn up into multiple judicial circuits. And the law, for one, you can't have separate laws in California and New Jersey under the federal law, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what surely will happen, Tim, is that states will enact toot suite, some taxing authorities to go after this. I mean, I'm surprised I haven't gotten a notice already. Like, you know, welcome to the new taxing regime from all these companies, you know, you do business with online. That's going to come. But what's going to happen is some courts will rule that a minimum number of transactions, like 200 that South Dakota has enacted, is maybe a state will do 10 minimum transactions, and a court will rule that that is impermissible. And then another court will rule that it is permissible for somebody to have X number of transactions, and there will be a split in the circuits, and the Supreme Court will have to resolve that. And it's one of the problems where when you see a case like this come down, you know, okay, now we're going for a decade or more of legislation that's going to have to
right.
kind of dot all the I's and cross all the T's for, you know, what actually, you know, they've created this kind of hash of an opinion. Where does the law come out? We don't really know. We're going to have to wait and see. It's going to have to be litigated. One thing we can be sure of is if states want to be consistent with where the law stands today, they can enact a system like South Dakota, which does have some exceptions for very small businesses that do, you know, relatively minimal amount of business in their states if they want to be in compliance. The minute they go beyond that, we'll see. We're going to have some challenges.
So we have the beginning of what the Doobie Brothers once called a long train running.
There you go.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Tim.
Don't forget to go to the Apple App Store or Google Play Store and download the new LibertyNation.com app for a facts-first look at all breaking news. The LibertyNation.com app is really all you need to be truly in the know. This is The Uprising, the podcast of LibertyNation.com. I'm Tim Donner.